Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Racial Peremptory Challenges Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 18, 2015, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Davis v. Ayala. The issue in this case was whether Ayala was entitled to federal habeas relief because the judge in his capital murder trial, when responding to Ayala's objection that the prosecution used its peremptory challenges to strike potential jurors based on race, excluded Ayala from the hearing during which the judge considered the prosecution's explanation for the peremptory challenges. The Ninth Circuit granted Ayala's petition for habeas relief. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court reversed the Ninth Circuit by a vote of 5-4 and remanded the case. Any federal constitutional error that may have occurred as a result of the exclusion of Ayala from the hearing, the Supreme Court held, was harmless with respect to all 7 prospective jurors who had been stricken. Justice Alito's opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Thomas, Scalia, and Kennedy. Justices Kennedy and Thomas filed concurring opinions. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg. To discuss the case, we have Ronald Eisenberg, who heads the Law Division of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Eisenberg.
Here at the end of the Supreme Court term, there's been some public debate about whether the court has recently shifted towards criminals in its criminal justice jurisprudence. Davis versus Ayala was a win for the prosecution, but it doesn't tell us a lot about the court's future direction. That is so, even though the case did present a boatload of interesting questions about constitutional criminal procedure and federal habeas corpus law. First was a question about alleged discrimination in jury selection under the court's landmark decision, Batson versus Kentucky. When the prosecution has to provide the trial judge with race-neutral reasons for striking potential jurors, may it do so in camera without the defense attorney present, is a contrary rule clearly established by prior United States Supreme Court precedent. And if the Constitution does forbid such a practice, can the error be harmless? If the state court finds that it was harmless, is that a determination of the merits of the Batson claim? Does a federal habeas court have to apply deference to the state court's harmlessness determination, as is generally required by the congressional statute known by its acronym as AEDPA? Must the federal court also apply the AEDPA deferential standard of review in deciding the underlying issue of whether any error occurred at all? Even if the state court skipped that aspect of the claim and proceeded directly to harmlessness. And finally, what exactly is the nature of the harmless error analysis that the federal habeas court must employ? What is the relationship between the pre-AEDPA standard laid out by the court in Brecht versus Abramson and the post-AEDPA standard? When Brecht says that the habeas petitioner must show actual prejudice, what does that mean in a case like this? Does the defendant just have to show that the trial court ruling might have been different if his lawyer had been present when the prosecutor spoke to the judge? Or does he have to prove that he actually would have changed the result? As it turns out, the decision in the Ayala case doesn't advance the ball much on any of these legal questions. In fact, it's possible in the long run that the case will be remembered less for the opinion of the court than for a concurrence by Justice Kennedy, which addressed a question, not raised by any of the parties or lower courts, concerning the onerousness of solitary confinement. Two things, at least, are clear. First, that the defendant lost, as he had in most of the lower courts, and second, that he's nevertheless been quite successful in postponing the punishment imposed by the jury and will likely continue to be successful despite his defeat in the highest court. In this respect, the court's most telling language may be the very first words in its opinion, that the decision comes, quote, a quarter century after a California jury convicted Hector Ayala of triple murder and sentenced him to death. Actually, the case goes back even further, to April 1985, 3 full decades ago. That was when Hector Ayala decided to rob a car repair shop in San Diego and to leave no witnesses behind. On the day of the robbery, Ayala and his cohorts took four employees hostage, bound them with duct tape, and demanded $10,000. One of the employees managed to squeeze under the garage door and escape. He was shot in the back as he ran, but survived. Meanwhile, each of the remaining victims was murdered execution style with two bullets to the head. The jury found Ayala guilty in 1989 and imposed the death penalty. During the pretrial jury selection process, which dragged on for 3 months, the defense claimed that the prosecutor was discriminating by using peremptory challenges against minorities. The prosecutor asked to speak to the judge privately to explain the race-neutral reasons for his strikes, and the judge agreed. In fact, it is common practice for defense attorneys to request private conferences with trial judges in order to make arguments without revealing trial strategy to the other side. Federal courts have split on whether such a procedure is available to the prosecution in responding to Batson challenges. Ayala raised that question on direct appeal, which he managed to drag out for almost a decade. In the end, the California Supreme Court affirmed the conviction, but without deciding that particular issue. Instead, the court held that even if the trial judge had erred by speaking to the prosecutor privately, the error was harmless because the lengthy voir dire record showed that the prosecutor really did have race-neutral reasons and that there was therefore no Batson violation. By now, the case had entered the new millennium, and Ayala began the federal habeas phase of his appeals, which has consumed 15 years. The federal district court agreed with the state court's ruling, holding under AEDPA deference that the state court's harmless error determination was not unreasonable. But the Ninth Circuit became the first and only court to rule the other way in a 2-1 decision. The majority held that it was not required to give any deference to the state court's ruling. The court concluded that defense counsel's absence when the prosecutor stated his reasons may have affected the trial court's Batson ruling. It therefore threw out Ayala's conviction. The state asked for en banc re-argument, but the Ninth Circuit refused over the dissent of seven judges. The Supreme Court granted certiorari review. Now the court's decision is in, and it's rather fact-specific. The court declined to decide the issue of ex parte Batson proceedings, holding, like the California Supreme Court, that the case could be fully resolved through harmless error analysis, without determining whether any error actually occurred. Next, the court pronounced perfunctorily that the state court's harmlessness decision was a decision on the merits, entitled to AEDPA deference review. Although the Ninth Circuit had held to the contrary and the parties' briefs had discussed the issue extensively, the court stated that the question had already been settled in one of its prior per curiam decisions. Nor did the court have much to say about the standard for assessing harmless error on federal habeas review. The court reiterated a statement it had previously made that the Brecht standard, quote, subsumes the AEDPA deference owed to state court harmless error decisions, even though Brecht predated the passage of AEDPA. Thereafter, the opinion seemed to treat the standards as interchangeable, sometimes employing language from the Brecht opinion and sometimes using language from its AEDPA deference decisions. Most of the majority opinion consisted of a detailed factual discussion of the prosecutor's reasons for striking various jurors and of the defense arguments against those reasons. The court concluded that the exclusion of Ayala's trial lawyer from the Batson discussions was harmless error, that Ayala did not suffer actual prejudice, and that the state court's ruling was entirely reasonable. The dissenting justices proceeded along similar lines, but to the opposite conclusion. The dissent insisted that exclusion of defense counsel was not harmless, but avoided analysis of whether that exclusion was error, that is, whether the Supreme Court has established a constitutional right for counsel to be present in these specific circumstances. Nor did the dissent address the implications of AEDPA for reviewing a state court ruling on harmless error. Instead, the dissenting opinion focused on the pre-AEDPA Brecht standard, seizing on language from another pre-AEDPA opinion applying Brecht, and describing that standard as requiring reversal whenever a federal court is, quote, in equipoise about whether an error was actually prejudicial. The dissent then, like the majority, spent most of its time discussing specific facts from the voir dire, none of which is entirely enlightening for future cases. Which brings us to the concurring opinion by Justice Kennedy. The concurrence is somewhat unusual in the sense that it does not depart from the reasoning of the court's majority. On the contrary, Justice Kennedy begins by emphasizing that his agreement with the majority opinion is unqualified. Indeed, he says, the opinion is complete and correct in all respects. Nevertheless, Justice Kennedy writes to address a question that was raised at oral argument about what he describes as a factual circumstance that has no direct bearing on the precise legal questions presented by this case. In actuality, the question was raised at oral argument by Justice Kennedy himself, and only after the defense had finished its presentation and the Chief Justice had called time. The question was about the subject of solitary confinement, a subject that neither party had raised. In his concurring opinion, Justice Kennedy expounds on, quote, the human toll wrought by extended terms of isolation, citing authority from Charles Dickens to Amnesty International. He equates solitary confinement with administrative segregation and describes its usual pattern as 23 hours a day in a windowless cell the size of a parking space with little or no interaction with anyone and no type of other diversion. Although Justice Kennedy's opinion does not address this issue in legal terms, the apparent implication is that solitary confinement may give rise to challenges under the Eighth Amendment as cruel and unusual punishment. I'll leave that legal issue aside for now, but there are two other issues, one of fact, one of death penalty politics, that are worthy of note. First, Justice Kennedy's description of solitary confinement as the equivalent of administrative segregation is questionable. Administrative segregation usually describes a temporary form of internal discipline for disruptive and dangerous inmates, whether they are serving a sentence of 1 year or life. Solitary confinement, on the other hand, may describe any inmates, and often death row inmates, who are single-celled, that is, who don't have a roommate. That is the norm on death row in my state, Pennsylvania. Recently, I attended a hearing on capital punishment convened by the Judiciary Committee of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. I heard the testimony of a legal scholar, Professor Robert Blecker, who has extensively studied death row conditions around the country. He does this by going inside, alone, chatting individually with murderers and prison guards, questioning administrators, and observing. Professor Blecker recently spent 2 days studying death row at a state correctional institution in Pennsylvania. He reported that inmates there do indeed spend 23 hours a day in single cells, but the cells are open barred. Residents are free to interact among themselves throughout the day, both orally and even visually by using mirrors. There is no mandatory lights out or quiet time. It is up to the inmates to regulate their socializing and sleep. During their daily recreation hour out of cell, they can meet in the death row common space or play a game of one-on-one on their basketball court. And for 90 days each year, that is, one out of every 4 days on an annual basis, each inmate acts as a custodian for the corridor, meaning they have janitorial duty during which they are free to roam the hallway, interacting with the other inmates and employees as they clean. Reading material is readily available, along with cable TV. There are death rows in other states with similar conditions, yet remonstrations about solitary confinement and life imprisonment are certain to play a profound role in the national debate about the death penalty. Opponents of capital punishment routinely argue that the death penalty is unnecessary, that any purpose it may serve can be met by isolation in prison for life under maximum security, and that such a sentence is even more onerous than a quick death. At the same time, however, many of these same advocates are already gearing up to attack the solution they themselves propose as inhumane, along the lines laid out in the concurring opinion. If they succeed in abolishing the death penalty, in converting every death sentence to a life sentence, it apparently won't be long before those very life sentences become the next target. In the meantime, while judges and law professors debate about which is the harsher punishment, the death penalty or life imprisonment, Defendants and their lawyers have been quite clear through their actions about where they stand. They are voting with their appeals, in which they generally seek to overturn the death sentence and replace it with life. Although a small percentage of death row inmates have volunteered to give up their appeals, the vast majority will take as many as they can get, even if it means they have to spend more time in a solitary prison cell, even if, like Mr. Ayala, it takes a quarter century.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.